Of course, we've all heard the phrase, make America great again. Author Wallace Henley says we should seek to, quote-unquote, make America godly again. Henley writes, since Nimrod, at least, mighty hunters before the Lord, Genesis 10:9, have been promising people some form of the new Jerusalem. The result usually has not been the heavenly city, but hellish Babylon, empires and social systems ruled over not by God and his transcendent majesty, but by sin-corrupted petty pretenders who mistake raw power for authentic authority, end quote. So writes author Wallace Henley in an article in Christian Post, which we'll link, entitled Make America Godly Again. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Wallace Henley joins us now. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And before we get into the meat of this whole idea of making America godly again, and I agree with that whole point, I still think there were ways in which Trump, in his Make America Great Again, contributed some positive things to America.
In fact, he supported many, many things that I, as an evangelical Christian, support today. And I appreciate what he did in regard to life and family and other types of emphases that he made. So I'm not saying that it was he who destroyed Christianity in America. What I'm talking about is the need for a recovery of values at the deepest level, at the heart of the culture.
So in other words, part of the whole problem is we the people need to be godly again, is your point.
You cannot make America great or godly again by some kind of executive fiat. I appreciated his emphasis all the way through that he was going to be taking stands on issues that we care about, like life I just mentioned. But at the same time, we've lost it as a people. And one of the reasons we've lost it as a people is because the drift in so many of the pulpits across the culture have been more toward this internalized psychological gospel rather than a declaration of the transcendence of God, the holiness of God, which was well understood in the 18th century. I'm not saying that our founders were all deeply, deeply, deeply rooted Christians, but they understood a common worldview that was based on the transcendence and the accountability of God. We've got to recover that. That's what will make America great again.
That's interesting because, you know, you look at somebody like Jonathan Edwards. He preached a sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and historians tell us that it was the preaching of Jonathan Edwards in New England, and then later on the British evangelist George Whitefield came over to America, another fellow Calvinist, and he preached up and down the coast. In effect, the message of starting with Edwards in Massachusetts and then spreading all through all the other colonies, that spawned the Great Awakening. Historians tell us the Great Awakening helped pave the way towards American independence, America becoming a free and separate nation.
Precisely. Benjamin Franklin even observed one time, I can hardly walk through a street in the city of Philadelphia at night without hearing through an open window a hymn or a Bible verse or a prayer being lifted up. Even people like he were impacted by this move of God in the colonies.
In your article about making America great again, I'm sorry, making America godly again, you talk about a study by Charles Heineman and Donald Lutz where they looked at sources that were influential to America's founders. Can you comment on that study and why it's of relevance to today?
Yes, they wanted very much to understand what shaped the worldview that brought this nation into being. And they discovered that the sources mostly quoted by the founders was either the Bible or that kind of literature that the Bible produced. Though that was the large degree, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but that was the large degree of the sources they drew from based on their quotes and other literature.
Yes, in fact, I am familiar with that study because I had the privilege to interview Donald S. Lutz, formerly of the University of Houston. He's retired now, but he wrote a great book called The Origins of American Constitutionalism. Anyway, he said that four times more than they quoted any other human source, they quoted four times more the Bible, and the book of the Bible that they quoted the most was the book of Deuteronomy. And then as far as human sources are concerned, the founding fathers quoted the most these three sources in this order. Ready? Montesquieu, Sir William Blackstone, and John Locke. And this is very important because all three of those were not only professing Christians, but they had a biblical worldview. The Bible helped give birth to, you know, America as a nation.
Well, then that's the heart of the matter. Every nation, in a sense, is built on a worldview. And the worldview not only expresses the way people interpret reality, but it reveals what they value, what they care about. And had it not been for that early foundation, I doubt if slavery would have been removed as it was eventually, because once that seed got planted in the Bible, that biblical worldview that all are created equal before God, once that seed got into the Constitution, into the Declaration of Independence in the preamble, that seed was there, and it would ultimately grow into that which would produce poison for the slavery movement. So we have to understand that it was worldview that produced values, that produced a nation that understood what needed to be done and sacrificed itself, if I may say so, in the process of trying to rid itself of this cancer.
You know, it's so interesting, though. In some ways, there's a dilemma, and here's the dilemma, and that is that when people do become godly, over time, it just happens because the way they start to develop different habits and so forth in their godliness, they also start often to prosper. And then in their prosperity, they often forget God, who was the source of their prosperity in the first place. So it's like this old statement from Cotton Mather, one of the Puritans. He observed in 1702, religion begat prosperity, and the daughter hath consumed the mother. I think in one sense, that one sentence summarizes America in all of its, 400 years of history.
Jerry, I have to say that I spent 3 years on the staff of the Nixon White House. And when I left the White House in 1973, I left with the conviction that the most powerful organism in our culture is the local church. The most important organism in our culture is the local church. Because obviously institutions, large institutions, are going to forget the way. But with that pulpit, as it was in the days leading up to the Great Awakenings, with that pulpit continually pounding away and keeping the idea before the people that we must not forget the transcendence of God, when that pulpit begins to go quiet, then other things begin to happen. And that's when the forgetfulness comes in. If you look at Old Testament Israel, you will see that it went through a process that we've reflected in our own time. It begins with a unanimity, a consensus, a general consensus around the idea of God, that God is in charge, that he is the Lord of the nation as well as the Lord of the individual. Then this goes into a time of great prosperity and great success, just as you said, when if the churches are not holding to that basic and foundational truth, then it will be forgotten. And that's what we saw in our culture.
So in other words, in order to make America godly again, there's a need to make America's churches godly again, in effect.
I think that's exactly right. And I think a letter writer in the Christian Post of my column said that very thing, and I agree with it wholeheartedly, that the churches, if the government tries to make us godly, all we've got is a cruel, strong, forceful theocracy. We're not looking for that. What we're looking for is a bottom-up revival, a bottom-up revival that saturates the whole of the culture, that goes back to its understanding of the transcendence of God, our accountability before God, and therefore the need to construct our institutions around that basic worldview.
Should our Christian faith apply to how we live our lives? I mean, of course it should, but I just want you to kind of spell that out. What does that mean for the Christian lawyer? What does that mean for the Christian journalist? What does that mean for the Christian economist or the Christian accountant?
There is a worldview that has to drive every profession. And if that worldview is corrupt, in fact, every profession will be guided by a worldview. And if that worldview is corrupt, then the practice of that will be corrupt. When I was in the political world and in government, there was much to observe at that level. I came to respect people that had embraced the values and could carry those values into the culture. I knew Charles Colson before his conversion to Christ and after his conversion to Christ. He was in jail for Watergate related issues just 3 hours from where I was living at the time. And some of my colleagues from Washington called and asked me to go and see him. So I did. And I saw in Chuck's behavior a complete change, not only in the ontological side, that is the being, the man that he was, but in his practical side, in his expressional side, as he was at that time already ministering to inmates in the jail who were coming to ask him for advice. And I saw the birthing of the Christian movement and prison fellowship out of those moments in his life. That was one example. And then I would see others. I would see Harry Dent, my dear friend in the Nixon White House, would leave and he would go back to South Carolina, have a law practice. Ultimately, the impact of salvation was so strong on him that he becomes the director for the Billy Graham Association. So I've seen that happen, and it's true. But we also must carry it through in our present moments and the way we shape our values in the way we approach policy. This is crucial.
You know, it's an interesting thing that you would bring up Chuck Colson in that particular, you know, context, because Colson was a great example of everything you're talking about. And even later on in life, he started to develop a really strong, fully orbed Christian world and life view. And, you know, worldview is so important because, again, our faith should inform how we think of the world. It shouldn't just be some sort of like a, you know, this is an hour long thing that we do on Sunday mornings, or 3 hours if we go, you know, happen to go to Sunday school and get some fellowship also. In other words, God's word should really shape every aspect of our lives and not, you know, us kind of just, you know, reading a few Bible verses here and there and not really living it out.
Well, this is an organic issue, not an institutional issue. And that's what you're speaking to, and I agree totally with it. One of the things that he and I laughed about at one point was the fact that some gentlemen came in and started a prayer group in the White House, which they had done in other administrations. And somebody asked me, do you think we ought to invite Colson to this prayer group? And I remember laughing and saying Colson would choke us, man. He would knock us out, man, if we asked him to a prayer meeting. And lo and behold, that's exactly what God ultimately would use to bring him in. But it was not institutional. It was not something he was going to politicize. It was something he was going to live out. And this is what the church needs to call for. This is what the church needs to present as a challenge. We need to get back to that understanding that we will never have psychological rest until we have spiritual peace. And we will never have a nation that is spiritually geared as the early founding was, with the sense of God's presence and the sense of God's blessing, until we understand our accountability before God. And that demands that we understand the transcendence of God. I've just written a book entitled Who Will Rule the Coming Gods? The Looming Spiritual Crisis of Artificial Intelligence. And this is the great concern I have now. Who are the people who are programming ethics into those machines? We're going back to a creation point right now, when we've got to ask the question, what kind of people are designing those things that will have power over us? That was a basic and a very rudimentary question, indirectly asked in the founding of the nation itself.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left. What do you want to say in conclusion?
Let's get back to God's purity, the word of the pure word of God. Let's focus on his holiness and his transcendence and our accountability before him.
All right, Wallace Henley, thank you so much for being with us. Again, the name of his article is Make America Godly Again, and we're linking to that. And this is an article found in ChristianPost.com. Wallace, all the best, and thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure, Jerry. Thank you.